Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One. Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One.
Well, we'll talk to Megyn Kelly for an hour, and Megyn, very revealing, very open, talking about her first marriage and things like that, things I didn't know about Megyn Kelly. So we'll talk to her, and in a second, first I'll tell you about Blinds Galore. I love these guys. I have them in my bedroom. I have them in my kitchen. I have them everywhere. I have them in my office. I have them in my studio. I have my edit bays. It's all Blinds Galore. First place to buy custom blinds and shades and shutters as well. Hand-built from scratch, delivered right to your door, and created just for your window. Save a ton compared to big box stores. Designer look without the designer price. And fall is here and winter's around the corner. Insulate your windows with cellular shades and drapery panels as well. Even connect your shades to your smart home and Amazon Alexa. It's Blinds Galore. Right, Dawson?
BlindsGalore.com makes it easy to get the safe, high-quality designer blinds and shades you've always wanted in your home, all at a great price, all at up to 45% off. See for yourself at BlindsGalore.com today and let them know Adam sent you. That's BlindsGalore.com. The Adam Carolla Show presents Megyn Kelly's Birthday Cocktail Party for November 18th. Let's see who's on the guest list. African-American abolitionist and women's rights advocate, Sojourner Truth. The oldest woman ever to live in the United States, dead at 116 years old, Carrie White. One of the chemists who helped develop the first atomic bomb at the Manhattan Project, George Kistiakowsky. The inventor of the Gallup poll, George Gallup. And the party attendees are split on whether they like him or not. Moon River, Johnny Mercer is here. American actress and Marlon's sister, Jocelyn Brando. British test pilot, Bill Bedford, crashes the party. Astronaut, Alan Shepard. Mickey Mouse is here, and he is animated. Author and poet, Margaret Atwood. Actor, Delroy Lindo. Kevin Nealon is here. The rocker who sang Naughty Naughty and St. Elmo's Fire, John Parr. Quarterback for the Houston Oilers, Warren Moon. Owen Wilson. Duncan Sheik is here, and he's barely breathing. Can we get a medic? And from the office and Adam's former stand-in, Oscar Nunez. Megyn Kelly is on the Adam Carolla Show.
Great to see you again, my dear.
Great to see you too. Man, I'm in good company. I really only knew about Mickey Mouse.
Yeah, that was a very well-attended cocktail party for your birthday. Normally there's six or seven people. You seem to have 13. The podcast, by the way, The Megyn Kelly Show, is available as we speak on Apple Podcasts and Spotify as well. So, Megyn, I'm a fan of yours.
Thank you.
I have a couple of random thoughts for you.
Okay.
I always think to myself, you know, like as a guy and as and when I was coming up in comedy and I was coming up in comedy with Jimmy Kimmel, and our aesthetic was neither here nor there. We're just dudes who were telling jokes, and if either you're funny or you weren't funny, but the aesthetic was just sort of 30-year-old white dude who cared, sort of thing. But obviously you're a very striking person. Like you have a strong aesthetic, and you know, I don't want to get into the like, well, shucks and all that, but according to standards, you're a very attractive person. So it is going to factor in to what you're doing, and it'll factor in a positive way and possibly a negative way. Like some of it'll be like, oh, good, she'll get the job because we want to look at her. And the other part might be, well, we can't take her seriously. She's a beautiful blonde. So, but living inside your aesthetic, how does it factor in for you?
I mean, for me, it's like being a poser, because I wake up with the real me, the real face, the hair when it's wet, and I look hideous. And it's not like I picture myself as that drowned rat that comes out of the shower when I think of what I look like, but I definitely don't think like I'm hot. Now, I feel like I can get there with the right team behind me, like makeup and hair and all that. I can get there. But when I just think about me, I just think about, you know, I'm just a girl from Albany. I'm nothing special to look at, but it's enough for me that I can sort of dance in those shoes every once in a while, you know. But can I say one other thing? There have been times where I have been underestimated because, you know, my hair sometimes is long and blonde. And when I was in law school, it was really long. And I knew people were underestimating me. And I recently saw a T-shirt. I'm like, oh, I like that. And the T-shirt read, underestimate me. See how that goes. Now, right. I love that.
Right. So I guess what I'm saying is it's a factor that has to be sort of reconciled or thought about to some degree. I mean, it's weird because you never really know how people perceive you, because you always just feel like you getting out of the shower with a zit. You know what I mean? Like, you're always that person. But it does factor in from a societal standpoint. And so you're never really sure, like, am I getting this job because of my chops, because of my skills, because of my aesthetic? And, you know, I always would sort of say to people that my white male heterosexual privilege was really just knowing I didn't have a privilege. Like, that was my privilege was understanding I just had to go to work. That was the privilege. So for you, and it's probably an unanswerable question, but like, was that something that you thought about when you were in high school, when you were in college, that here's how people will perceive me, here's how I need to conduct myself? Was there those thoughts?
Well, two different layers there. In high school, being hot is important because it leads to popularity and boyfriends. So I tried very hard back then to make a silk purse out of the sow's ear. I mean, it was all I really cared about in high school was being popular. I didn't care about my academics. And even though I wound up at that lofty institution, Syracuse University, it was hit or miss, you know, like I just didn't care. I was smart. So I kind of naturally got decent grades. There was nothing to write home about. And that was good enough for me. I just wanted to be like prom queen. That's really where I was. And frankly, in defense of myself, you know, my dad had died my sophomore year of high school. So I was kind of a little listless for a lot of the years there. And I was very focused on having a boyfriend and like felt taken care of. And you have to be good looking to get, you know, the captain of the football team, which is the person with the most social currency in school. And if you have that, you have protection from the bullies. This is all my mindset back then. And then when I got out in the professional world, I mean, it's a longer story than we have time for, but the short version is I met a guy in college who changed my life. He changed who I am. He really did it for the better. He was a really important person in my history. His name is Jim. And he was the captain of the Syracuse lacrosse team that won 3 national championships. So like, this guy knew about winning and he knew about good attitudes and he really helped me with my confidence. And honestly, from that point forward, I never really had it baked into my looks. I knew I had a good personality. I knew I was strong. I knew I was smart. I knew people generally perceived me as very confident. And that was good enough. Like, I knew even at my least attractive, I did well. Like, I have a good way of communicating with people, sort of like I can penetrate the lens on television for the same reason if you're talking to me in a room. I know how to make myself understood. And honestly, that's a better gift than good looks, which of course fade and are really kind of false to begin with. Very few women I know look amazing without all this stuff. So anyway, it's a long-winded answer, but I do think that boyfriend was important to me and just developing confidence in like what I'm saying as opposed to how I'm appearing.
Your dad dying when you're 15 is pretty devastating. I mean, I have twins that are 14. And boy, girl, certainly my son would be devastated if I died. I don't know. I'm not sure if my daughter would be or not. But let's just say for the sake of argument, she'd be devastated as well. I mean, they're, you know, 8 months away from being 15. So that happening at 15. And I think there's also something to a daughter and a husband, a father, you know, dying, there is something to that connection, you know, like they do say, if you're a man and you need therapy and you're having difficulty with women, get a female therapist, you know, and maybe vice versa. So for you, how did that affect you and how important was that?
Well, so yeah, I mean, I was basically 9 months older than your daughters are now, because he died 1 month after my 15th birthday, and it was 10 days before Christmas, and he was 45 years old.
Wow.
And he'd had no prior health issues, and, you know, the Christmas tree was on in our house, and unfortunately, we were in a fight, and I know I've talked to you before, you have the same with your kids, it's just part of growing up, but I was being a bratty teenager that night. I was pissed off about my school ring. I wanted a nicer one. Hmm. And my dad said we couldn't afford it. And I was mad. And I said something, you know, petty. And he walked out. He didn't say anything nasty, but he walked out of the room. And he's just like, had it. And my last sight of him was he was sitting alone in the living room next to the Christmas tree, just by himself. And I went up the stairs. I went into my bed. And like 2 hours later, my older sister woke me up saying, wake up, Daddy had a heart attack. And he never came back. He had a massive heart attack and never was resuscitated. And it's like the number one thing I remember from the year or two that passed after was my mom. You know, my mom was 44. She had three kids, two of whom were in college, one of whom was a sophomore in high school, me. And she was a nurse. You know, my dad, he had a life insurance policy, but he had just canceled the supplemental that would have paid off our house. Because he's 45 years old. He wasn't thinking anything was going to happen.
Right.
And so my mom had to struggle. It's just like such a hard time. Like seeing your mom struggle like that in addition to your own. So it was just awful. But I think the number one thing that happened to me as a result of my dad dying was I live my life truly in a way where I know that no tomorrow's promised. And I've made massive changes in my life. I mean, I have a history to prove this. I've made massive changes in my life personally and professionally that back it up. So, you know, I don't want to say it was a gift, but if you're looking for a silver lining, there is one there. I think about it all the time. I think about it every day with my own kids still.
So you had an argument with your father the night before he died. And I'm guessing that's probably not the way you wanted to leave things with him, but I'm also guessing you were a pretty good kid and he was a pretty good dad and he probably loved you and knew you loved him. But does it haunt you? Are there sort of residual feelings to that? Do you wish that, obviously you wish that wasn't the note you went out on, but does it, how's it
feel?
I don't
know. My dad, like he was always, my mom, she's Italian and my dad was Irish. So my mom was always the big personality, the disciplinarian. She was the one we were afraid of. You know, my dad never, he was this gentle guy. He was a professor and he was professorial. You know, he was always erudite and using the big words with us. And we'd be like, Dad, speak English. And he'd be like, I will not lower my vocabulary to meet yours. You must raise your vocabulary to meet mine. But he was great. He'd be the first guy to get on the floor and play jacks with you and so on. So like the loss of that sort of, not to say more loving, but like just sort of steady, sweet parent, you know, my mom's more fiery and my dad called her Mother Earth and she is, hurt. You know, you didn't have sort of that balance in the house. But I think not only was I in a fight with my dad the night he died, my mom was in an argument with him. Mm. And the saddest part of all, the saddest thing that like, I can't even, but you guys out there will understand, he died on a Sunday night. And that day, my brother was at RPI, which is near Albany, where I'm from, this is his college. And my dad called him and asked him if he wanted to come over and watch the Giants play, because that's their team and our team. And my brother wanted to watch the game with his friends, so turned him down. It's still 30 years later, it like makes me upset. My poor brother, you know, was just so, he has to live with that, you know, like that's, I think even worse than what I have to live with. He didn't do anything wrong. Right. Like,
right.
Well, you do that. Like, whatever. You want to hang with your friends. He was only, you know, he was 20. I don't know. It brings you closer as a family. And I know my dad knew I loved him. It didn't matter about some stupid argument over a class ring. Like we had so many wonderful days prior to that and very few arguments in them. But it does make you think about how you are with your own family, like my own nuclear family now that I'm building. And like, what matters, right? Like what's worth, not to say we never go to bed angry, but like, what's worth it? Like, really think about it. Because I will say so far, my kids are still little. They're 11, 9, and 7. So far, I've never gone to bed angry with them. I'm sure it's coming as the teenage years come. Sometimes Doug and I do, but, you know, it is something to think about because, God, you hate to have any regrets when somebody goes so quickly.
Well, it's interesting, and it's something I think about quite frequently, like how many wasted days in our lives, how many wasted moments, and just sort of, I'm not talking about arguments per se, but I just mean like how many things that could have gone this way and would have easily gone that way, and we had to have so many discussions and then hurt feelings and then maybe apologies and then like how often we go through that dance and that process when it's probably not that necessary. Mm-hmm. You know, and maybe it's a male-female thing. Like, maybe it's just a wiring thing. And maybe...
I don't think so. Because I have to say, I'm super quick to forgive. I almost never hold a grudge. Like, I forgive pretty much everybody and everything. Maybe it's the Catholic in me. I don't know. But I just feel like, what a waste of time. As you were saying to me not long ago, I don't have time to waste on these petty sins that everybody's trying to hold against everybody everywhere these days. You know, I might find them irritating. I might, you know, slam somebody for doing something really stupid that hurt people. But like, I'm pretty quick to move past it because, you know, what? Why walk around with those bitter pills all inside of you? You know, life really is too short. And it's not like I'm skipping to my loo every day. You know, I'm like, I'm not built like that either. I am Irish after all. So that's not the alternative, but to walk around with all the bitterness built up in you and like holding grudges and hating that one, like, Jesus, like we're going to die and we're not getting these days back. And unless you believe in reincarnation, you really need to work harder on making this one better.
Well, I agree. And so one of the theories I have, and I've talked to Dr. Drew about it many, many times, and you maybe fall under this canopy, which is, see, I when I say feminine and masculine, I don't really mean male and female. I mean, there's some women that have a sort of masculine mindset or wiring or temperament or something. For instance, I live in Los Angeles. Eric Garcetti is our mayor. He is much more feminine in his wiring than Megyn Kelly is. Like,
I think you're probably right.
You obviously look better in a sundress than he does, but in terms of your wiring, again, I'm not trying to assign a pejorative. I'm just saying he has a more feminine wiring and you probably have a more masculine wiring, a little more brass tacks, nuts and bolts, like, let's get this done. I don't want to talk about this again. You know, sort of a wiring that's that way. And that wiring is a kind of a pragmatism, right? Like, I've talked to you a bunch of times. You're very pragmatic in your wiring. And I don't know where it comes from. I don't know what the origins are, but it's a sort of a pragmatic wiring. Would you say you have that?
I think that's right. And I think that's the reason for me in my life. I pretty much weed out anybody who's prone to drama.
Right.
Not long after I meet them. I can't. And like, unfortunately, it's not all women, but there are a lot of women who are very prone to drama.
There's a lot of men nowadays that are prone to drama.
I don't know. I guess I don't know as many of them because they're just not in my life. And I live in New York City where it's like, I don't know, it's like a lot of testosterone.
Look for guys wearing wooden bracelets, like the wood bead bracelets. that'll help you find those guys.
Okay. I'll search them out.
Please.
But it's like, bad things happen, you know, like Corona has been sort of a good example because Corona's bad. You know, it's like a lot of people have died. I know people who have died. It's upsetting. But like some people, the people who are like, let's stay shut down forever. We can't leave our houses until there's a vaccine and a perfect cure. You know, the lockdown needs to take place no matter how old. The preschool kids need to be wearing the mask 24/7. To me, those people are more prone to like, I don't want to say hysteria, that's too strong, but to just drama. They're attracted to it. They need it in their lives. And then I think there are people who are more like, it's another thing. You're going to have to deal with it. There's nothing's gained by like completely freaking out over it. And people are like telling their kids, like they've got their kids all freaked out. I'm like, you guys are going to have to wear masks. Be careful. Wash your hands. Hand sanitize more than normal. You're good. That's it. Like, I don't know. I don't understand the need to like create, like make it all your own. Like somebody, right. Something awful happens to somebody on television. You make it your own. Like it happened to you. Well, it didn't happen to you. So like, don't, so much borrowed worry that people adopt. And that to me, it's like, well, you could also go suck on the pipe of that bus spitting out all that exhaust all day. It would probably do the same thing to you. Better to just move on. Whatever you have to do to like click that brain, like move forward.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think a lot of it is narcissism. A lot of it is, you know, could happen to me, could happen to my children. You know, for me, statistics are statistics. It's either going to happen to you or it's not going to happen to you, but there's no, you can't weave you into the statistics. So if one out of every 43 men gets colon cancer, then that's the statistic. I can't weave my colon into that statistic. I'm just one of 43 men. That's sort of...
Never leave your house. Yeah. The number of illnesses that are out there and viruses that are out there and bad guys who are out there. In New York City, it's like a scaffolding is everywhere. The air conditioners could fall on you. It's like, you'd never leave your house if you thought that way.
Right. And why is this? So let's try to figure it out. So obviously, the Democrats I know are much more worried about this, and the Republicans I know are much less worried about it. And you go, well, the Republicans are on the side of the president, and he's playing it down, and the Democrats are on the side of Joe Biden, and he's playing it up. Fine. There's that. But then beyond that, what do you think is sort of coursing through the veins of the people, let's just say pre or in a vacuum of Trump? Who knows what Trump's thoughts on COVID-19 are, and who knows what Biden's thoughts on COVID-19 are? With that all removed, with all the politics removed, how come the Republicans don't really seem as nearly as concerned as the Democrats?
I mean, I can't speak for all of them, you know, but I think there's a general leaning in the Republican Party toward personal responsibility and like the surrender to the idea that you can't control everything. And I think you're seeing that with their response to some of these mask mandates and keeping the economy shut. It's like, that's when people freaked out about Trump having the so-called super spreader event with Amy Coney Barrett. I understand that, you know, it probably was. It looks like it was. But I think most of the people there understood there's COVID. They understood Trump 74. They understood somebody there could have it. And they went anyway. No one made them take off their masks. They chose to do it. And I understand the argument that maybe that was irresponsible to those who were then in their path. But for themselves, I think there's a general attitude of, I might get it, and then I'll deal with it, and then we'll go forward from there. And if I expose myself, I'm probably not going to go visit my 80-year-old grandmother. You know, like, whereas I think Democrats are more like, everyone has to work collectively. It's a global society. You know, we're global citizens. That's why you have to keep your temperature at, like, 55 in your house, and you can't drive an SUV. It's like, and Republicans are like, I really like my big car, and I'm going to keep it on 72, and I'm sorry you don't like it, but this is how I see the world. I don't see myself as responsible for, you know, seven generations from now and the people in other countries who aren't doing this with their heat and electric. You know, I think there's a general mindset between those two groups.
Yeah, so it's interesting. So there's a kind of collective mindset, which is it takes a village to raise a child. We can all somehow, California is going to fix global warming. Somehow California, like if you went to outer space and you look down at the globe, you'd see California would look like the pimple on the ass of John Goodman. But somehow that pimple is going to fix the entire body of John Goodman. So somehow,
how's that going?
Yeah, well, that's the whole thing. Like, California is very Democratic, it's very progressive, and it's very like, we are going to set the tone, we're going to fix this, we're going to lead the charge to that. And I think Republicans have a little more like, I'm Ted Nugent, I want a crossbow and a shotgun, and I want my own land. And if someone comes onto my land, I'm going to shoot them with my crossbow. That's so it's a kind of a collective sort of, it takes a village versus a kind of individual, leave me alone. I want to drive what I want to drive. And if I want to use charcoal in the backyard, I'm going to use charcoal in the backyard and grill a steak.
100%.
Right. So that seems to be what it is. So then when you come to COVID-19, the collective says, put a mask on, lock it down, wash your hands, social distance. And Ted Nugent says, get in the back of a pickup truck and crank up some country music and go have a party. So I get.
But yes. I will say this, like the Republicans, they did it. They did lockdown. They did quarantine. They were good. They listened to what, Fauci and all the others were saying, like, you got to do this for the sake of the nation and the hospitals, and said they did it. And there were real fears about what was going to happen to the economy. And sure enough, they all came true, and then some. And so I think Republicans got to the point where they were like, we did our part, we helped bend the curve, and now it's time to get back. And it's a lot of the Democrats, not all of them, but a lot of the Democrats are like, never. The goalposts keep getting moved. Now it's not like bend the curve. Now it's like there has to be a vaccine, there has to be a cure, and there has to be like, it's like that wasn't the covenant. Republicans did what they were willing to do, what they're capable spiritually of doing. I mean, I really think the Republican friends I have are like, they're done. They're done. They don't have it in them to live like this any longer. So I don't really know what more mandates are going to do or an attempt to close the economy. But I think there's a growing group of people in this country that are over the government literally trying to control how we breathe, how we walk around, whether we work. It's just totally un-American in its spirit the longer it goes on.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm curious why some people and a large group of people in our society are sort of attracted to the government and the government sort of telling them what to do, sort of lording their power over them. It feels very anti-American to me. For me, it feels sort of just anti-free human, that the government's going to kind of tell you what to do. And I don't really get what's attractive about that. It feels very unattractive to me that the thing that's kind of funny is if you take people on the left and, I don't really include liberals in this in a classic sense, but people on the left, you take people on the left and you show them that old Nike commercial from the 80s where everyone is sitting in the auditorium and they're watching this propaganda and they're all wearing, they're wearing gray jumpsuits and the woman runs down and launches the sledgehammer into the screen. And that is the government. That's like big government. That's the man. That's Orwellian. That's them telling you what to do and what you can't do. Why is that attractive? I live in California. It's like everyone in California votes for these people. Then these people tell them what they can and can't do. Like, okay, Halloween, no trick or treating. If you want to have a virtual haunted house, you may have a virtual haunted house. Like, these people are telling you what to do. This is big government. Why is this attractive to you?
Yeah. Well, the New Hampshire saying, live free or die.
Yes.
I think there's a reason, sort of more Republican-minded people are attracted to that state and that motto. And I think there's always been this divide between Democrats and their, great society, huge social programs, the government can fix it. Although 9 times out of 10, they've been manipulations, to get more Democratic voters in, to make people vote and behave the way big government wanted them to. But there's been this sort of, we will provide the social safety net and take care of you because you deserve it. Or as, I think it was God, who was it? Was it AOC? No. It was Elizabeth Warren who did her rant about, you know what? Great. You made billions. You made millions. Who built the roads that you rode to into your office space? Who built the bridges? You know, like you.
That was
a payback.
That was Obama. That was Obama.
Taxes look like, but I've always been a W-2 employee, and I give almost 50% of my money to the government. Almost 50%. I feel like that's enough. I've paid back my share of the road usage.
Obama did that whole.
Elizabeth.
Sorry, you broke up. But Obama did that whole speech of, you think you're smart, you think you work harder, who built the roads, what about the school teachers? That was Obama. I mean, AOC's probably done it. Elizabeth Warren's probably done it as well. But Obama famously laid that one out in 2012, so says our producer. Megan is locked up. We're having a little audio problem, so we'll figure that out.
Yeah, let's just wait for her internet to come back. Yeah.
All right, well, let me hit red cap here. As long as leave this in, Chris, but as long as Megan's getting her internet worked out, let me hit red cap. Comfort done right, making workwear and uniforms since 1923 for the essential workers making our communities thrive. Clothing for many industries: automotive, culinary, manufacturing, waste management. Oil block coveralls resist engine fluids. Oil just beads up and rolls off. That's what I'm saying. Latest project is for the road heroes, truckers. The Trucker Tab, $50,000 tab at Cracker Barrel. Feed our long-haul truckers. Check it out at truckertab.com. And these guys bring all our food in. They bring the gasoline in. They bring everything we have. Truckers bring it in. So let's support these guys, would you? And I've donated as well, and you should too. Go to truckertab.com. Red cap, workwear, done right. All right, so Megyn Kelly's rebooting her internet. That's fine. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back with Megyn Kelly right after this.
Adam Carolla's I'm Your Emotional Support Animal, navigating our all woke, no joke culture, has over 1,000 five-star reviews on Amazon. Here's one.
Another hilarious critical. I assume for taking the star, the old culture for Adam, 5-star.
Thanks, Ozzy. Pick up I'm Your Emotional Support Animal now. Available in all formats. For more, go to adamcarolla.com.
Megyn Kelly is back. The podcast, The Megyn Kelly Show. I was privileged to be on that show. New episodes every week on Apple Podcasts and Spotify as well. And you can shoot her a tweet at Megyn Kelly. So Megyn, when we were last speaking, we were talking about sort of Democrat, Republican fear versus reward. You know, it's interesting. I don't have a fear of COVID-19. I'm not a fearful person, and I do a lot of things that might fly in the face of fear. But I'm not a careless person. I race race cars, and I recently welded in an extra supplemental roll bar in one of my race cars because I didn't feel like it had enough side impact strength. I felt like it was a little bit dangerous. So I do things that are dangerous, but I try to make them safer. And there's an interesting perception that people like me just sort of laugh in the face of COVID and then eventually I'll get it and die. But it's really, I feel like I've weighed the risks and the rewards and I've just sort of weighed them and then gone about my life. I'm not flaunting it or turning my nose up at it. I understand there's a disease and there's a virus and it's potentially dangerous. And I understand that. I weigh it and I move on with my life. I think there's a thought that maybe people like you and I don't believe it or think it's a hoax or laughing at it. It's not that. We've weighed the danger and then we've decided to go about our lives in a certain way. Is that an accurate statement?
Absolutely. And I think even prior to this point in life, there were people like some of my friends who are hand sanitizing, I mean, till their hands are raw. Their kids can't get into the car without being made to use the hand sanitizer. They can't come into the house without being able to. It's like, Me, never. Prior to this, I've never used it. I've never made my kids use it. You know, we believe in washing our hands, but not the hand sanitizer. I want them to develop immunities. I want them to have healthy microbiomes. My son Thatcher, when he was 3, I turned around like, what are you doing? He's behind me. He was licking the scaffolding in New York. All right, that's too much. Hey, that's a bridge too far. But on balance, I was like, you know, it's probably good for them. Like, they need to eat some dirt. They need to get dirty. They need to, like, not be hermetically sealed little people. And that's actually one of my complaints and one of my worries about what's happening right now is, what the hell other bug is developing while we're all hand sanitizing to, you know, the high heavens that we don't know about, because none of it, we're all neglecting our microbiomes and, like, building up immunity. So I actually feel like I don't like that my kids must hand sanitize every time they walk into the school and every time they walk into a classroom. And, like, when you go into the shoe store, they're like, you hand sanitize right now. It's like, oh my God. It's a lot for people who, like, have a different approach in general to, like, health and well-being. And I knock wood have been healthy my whole life. I very rarely get sick. I feel like this has worked for me, and I kind of object to being put in, like, girl in the plastic bubble along with everybody else. And, you know, there's a team of scientists right now from Stanford, Oxford, and Harvard who are saying, we need to redo this. This is not working, and it's not smart. And what we need to do is make everybody who's 60 and older continue on as we've been continuing. They should be doing what we're doing right now. And everybody who's 59 and younger should be masks off in the workplace, in the restaurants, inside at 100% capacity, in the schools, no masks, no hand sanitizer, doing what we do. And they believe that herd immunity will come amongst the young people in particular and help us all out. And that even you and I, you know, at our age, we get it, we'd probably be okay. I think that makes a lot of sense, and it's a reasonable compromise position at this point in the game.
Yeah, I agree, and I'm with you on all the Purell and the sanitizing, and crazy. You know, it is crazy, and also it's like unintended consequences. Like, do you not think that they're going to be some fiddler to pay when you do X, Y, and Z? So if you said, okay, we're going to do affirmative action. Like, if you said colleges, you know, UCLA has too many Asian students and not enough black students. So what we're going to do is we're going to lower the SAT scores for the black students to get in, and we'll raise for the Asian students. And it's like, okay, that will get you more black students and less Asian students, but get back to me in 10 years and tell me how it's working out. Yeah. You tell me what there's unintended consequences. Not everything is free. You can't bathe your kids in Purell. You can't keep them safe from every peanut and legume and, you know, every allergy and lactose and blah, blah, blah. And then expect them to have a functioning system when they're 30.
Yeah.
It's not going to work.
It's a good point. The Purell is like it's like the version of a safe space, you mm-hmm. know, like, there can be no exposure to harm, bacteria, virus, dirt, whatsoever. I'm talking mostly about pre-COVID, you know, the people who are obsessing over, like, no germs, no germs. And, like, you got to take, like, we walk all over New York City. We do not take our shoes off when we come into our apartment, nor did we when we had little babies crawling all over the carpets. I don't want to live like that. I don't want my guests to have to live like that. Ladies, you know how annoying it is when they make you take off your shoes when you show up at the party. It's like, what? I just lost 4 inches. This outfit doesn't work without those stilettos. Anyway, so, like, it's the same mentality of there can be no hurt. You can not have your feelings hurt. You have to be protected. Little Johnny can't have any conflict in his life or his ideas challenged in any way, especially on social issues like abortion or faith in the public square and whatever. But you're right. And honestly, if you listen to really smart black scholars, I used to think affirmative action, that makes sense, right? Like, we need, it's good to fight racism to have more of the underrepresented group present, whether it's a corporation or a university, because that's how you, in my view, stop racism. You expose people who might have it to awesome people of the other races, and then they have their own private great experiences with them, and nobody needs to lecture them on how someone's not less than. They just know it internally. And there are a lot of people who grow up in areas where they have no black people. So it's like, college would be a good time to start that, right? If they have it. However, after listening to people like Glenn Lowry, you know, professor at Brown, formerly Harvard, black intellectual, huge, gentle, just mental giant, And not to mention Jason Riley of the Wall Street Journal, who wrote a great book called Please Stop Helping Us. What the studies show is that the kids who are quote unquote helped by affirmative action to get into these schools that they wouldn't otherwise be admitted to wind up doing very poorly for the most part. And they wind up, almost all of them, where they could have become engineers. A lot of them enter school wanting to be like an engineer or a science major. They can't cut it at UCLA. Whereas if they had gone to a lower school, like a lesser school, like a Syracuse, with all due respect to my alma mater, they could have done the sciences. They could have become an engineering major and gotten out and had a great engineering career. But at a school that's really tough, they can't do it. And they wind up being pushed into something like, 9 times out of 10, it's African-American studies, which really doesn't get you a job doing very many things that pay well. So it's like, well, how are we, exactly are we helping? That doesn't, and not to mention, it creates resentments. That's the other thing they found, is that it creates resentments from white kids who say, he just got in because he checked the box, which is like so totally unfair to the kids who didn't check the box. And it's like the kids who are being helped with it, they don't want to be known as the kid who checked the box either. It's like, if you went more with the natural order of things and just let people who's, you know, right now they're having their SAT scores raised 2 standard deviations, right? Like they're getting into these universities where they're 2 standard deviations below the average entrant. And then they get in there and they feel uncomfortable. They don't get asked into the study groups. I mean, this has all been documented. Read Heather McDonald. She's done a lot of this too. And they don't get asked to the study groups, and then they feel it's racism, right? They feel like there's a backlash against them because of the color of their skin. But meanwhile, it's because, let me tell you, if somebody gave me some sort of blonde affirmative action and sent me into Princeton, it would have been a disaster. No one would want to be in my study group either. And it would have been hurtful. It would have been a very negative experience. Whereas Syracuse, you know, is like, fine, I did well. I could do well enough to get into my law school. And it just had a different approach academically. And you know what? It worked out just fine. In the end, it worked out just fine. So like, you can get to the top of any given profession as long as you have positive experiences and your interactions with the world are positive. And I just don't think, having read a lot on this now, that affirmative action is setting black people up for success.
Yeah, it just doesn't work to sort of push people along or synthetically fix things. It just, I say synthetically, but what I mean is like, if you're checking account is low, we'll just put some money in your checking account without you earning it or working for it. The one thing I've really learned about life is you can't just sort of artificially make things work. You know, if you go, well, a lot of kids in Los Angeles, they're hungry at school. So, all right, well, we'll do a lunch program, and then we'll do a breakfast program, and then we'll do a program for their parents so their parents can eat. And it's like, that does, it's like the homeless problem in Los Angeles. Like, there's a homeless problem. Okay. It's homeless. These people need homes. So this create a home, and then the homeless people would have a home. And it sounds like it would work because that's the roller skate and the key. Like, they're homeless. They need a home. Give them a home. Doesn't, it just doesn't work. That I wish it did. It would be easier to, these problems would be solvable in many ways, but yes, it really, from a humanistic standpoint, it just doesn't work. Somehow it can't be done from the outside in. I was talking to a friend. I was watching football earlier today, and I said I was going to interview Megyn Kelly, and he said, did you see Bombshell? And I said, no, I didn't see Bombshell. But he said, Megyn Kelly's character in the story said something interesting, which is she got it. Like, she got her looks factored into her situation, what was going on. And I don't know what Charlize Theron, sorry, Theron. I don't know what your thoughts were on that movie. I don't know what your thoughts on being portrayed by, you could do worse than Charlize Theron. I can tell you that.
Certainly could. Well, I'll say this. We talked about looks earlier, but when it comes to television work, I do have specific feelings about it. And I don't make any apologies for looking good on television because it does help. It's a visual medium.
Right.
And anybody who wants to pretend that your looks are irrelevant is lying. They're lying. You need to look good. It's called broadcast journalism. It's not just about the journalism. It's also about broadcast and How are you on camera? How do you present yourself? How do you look? Are you distracting? Can you condense large amounts of information into small digestible bits in a short amount of time? So I want to bring my A game whenever I'm on camera. And, you know, the A game gets a little less than as I get older, but I don't care. I'm good enough. You know, I was like, I'm hanging in there. And I don't understand why people feel the need to pretend that it's not relevant. It is relevant. And that's why you don't see a lot of homely people on television all the time. I mean, come on. It's like that's the truth. As far as Charlize goes and that in the movie, I don't know her and I've never met her. And I had nothing to do with the movie. I feel like some people think I sort of had that movie made. I didn't have anything to do with the damn movie. And I had no say about the movie. And there was a lot I would have changed about the movie if I had been involved. But on balance, I think it was good because it shined a light on a very difficult situation. Because I don't know her, it was hard because, her press tour was like a little jarring. And she was talking about like when Megyn Kelly walks into a room, her emotional walls go up. And I was like, how do you know anything about what I'm like when I walk in? Like, you don't know me. You know, we've never met. So it got a little weird in through all of that. But I appreciate them shining a light on a tough story, the telling of which might help other women.
In the same vein, but maybe on the wrong side of the tracks. I was thinking about you the other day, and I was enjoying doing your podcast, and I always think to myself, I'm just a dude from the San Fernando Valley. Like, I'm just, I really am. I'm confused if someone said, oh, I like Adam. I'm almost confused. I really am. It's a weird no self-esteem the way I grew up, however that worked. But I do feel like in another life, we could have been a couple. Another galaxy, perhaps.
You know why I think that might have been possible? Because notwithstanding what you may have heard, I'm extremely low maintenance. Mm. I really am. Like, and I need to be with somebody who's extremely low maintenance. You know, like, I just want to, like, have a good time. And I'm really, like, my husband and I never fight. It's like maybe twice a year we'll have a row. But I just, like, this is your lover. This is your partner. This is your guy. Like, take it easy. Like, just chill. Unless he's being a complete ass. I don't know. And like, you got to marry somebody who's that way. You got to make sure you pick the right person. And I got lucky because mine's good looking too. But that's all I really care. I wanted somebody who didn't irritate me, but who listened to me and was smart, who I could have good conversations with. And you know what? You check all those boxes. So one never knows.
The day is young. Well, no, yeah. So again, that, like you said, I wanted to marry someone who didn't irritate me, which is, again, sort of going back to something we touched on earlier in the conversation, a little more of a masculine approach to marriage. Most women say, I wanted to marry someone who would worship me or who would make me feel X, Y, and Z. But saying, I wanted to marry someone who didn't irritate me, that sounds like a male speaking about the relationship. And again, it's like, it's not a pejorative at all.
No. I agree with you. And it's funny you should say it because I've always said about myself that I feel like I have more testosterone than the average woman. And again, in my case too, it's not a knock on other women. I feel in a lot of ways I have more of a man's mentality on a lot of issues. And I do not have a lot of tolerance for nonsense or drama. I really just don't. So yeah, like I see what you mean. You know, it's like, and even when we fight, my husband and I, Doug tells this story, but we had this one argument a couple of years ago where, I don't know, we had an argument at a restaurant and we got home and he, unlike me, like I, when we fight, I need to cool off for a little while. Like I can't make up immediately. But Doug is one of those people who needs to make up right away. Like he wants it, like we had a fight, now we should make up. And I'm like, no, I am half Italian. No, I need a little time. So he can't let it alone. So finally, like he was in the bed And he's like, come to bed. I'm like, no, I'm not ready. I'm going to the living room. He's like, no, come on, let's what, you're so mad about this thing, and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, I'm done. I don't want to talk about it. He's like, well, then just, like, you know, remember, this is what you did, and this is what, and I was like, and I turned around, and I gave him the double barrel, the double middle finger in a crouched position, like, shut up. And he was like, the double barrel. Okay, I got it. We both started laughing. Because he had just tweaked, like, I never get that mad, but he had tweaked me to the point where I think it's probably something most men might resort to. But it works. For whatever reason, it works.
Yeah, it's interesting. I keep thinking about this, because this sort of male mentality and female mentality, and again, it doesn't matter if it's in the body of a beautiful blonde woman, you can still have that sort of masculine mentality, and it shapes your point of view, and it's a little more brass tacks and a little less sort of feelings based, I guess. And then the question is, do you need that male-based mentality for the husband, or does it balance out better if the husband has a little more of the female-based mentality? I know many guys, I live in Hollywood, I know a lot of guys who have that sort of feelings-based feminine mentality, even though
they're not attracted to that. So that would not work for me. That doesn't turn me on, frankly. So it's like, the thing about Doug that, like, because I had a first marriage that didn't work out.
What years was that? Or how many years were you married?
2000 through 2004 or 5. 2001 we got married. Shit.
So
2001 we got married, we got divorced like 5 years later.
Why? Well, if you don't mind me asking, what do you think the problem was in that marriage?
Well, I mean, there's so many. I mean, let me start with this. We're still friends and he's a good guy. And he wound up getting remarried. He's got 3 kids just like I do. So it's all good in the end. But he is a doctor. He's a very successful doctor. And I was a lawyer. And I think when we got married, we were like, oh, cool. I was like, he's hot. He has a nice personality. He's going to make a lot of money. He's a professional. He's popular. Like, everybody likes him and I like him. So yeah, I'm going to cash in my chips. I don't see myself doing any better than this. And I think he was looking at me thinking the same. And that was just the wrong calculation. Dan is all about medicine and he loves sports a lot. I'm not really that into sports. I am not masculine in that way. And like, he loves gambling and that's not my thing either. So like, we just didn't have similar interests. And we grew apart. We were working so hard in our respective jobs. We never spent any time together at all. Like, he was going through his residency, his internship, his fellowship. And I was making my bones at Jones Day, this high power law firm. So, you know, we just grew apart and it was like, I don't think this is the right relationship for me. And we hadn't had kids yet. So it was like, now's the time to go. If we're going to go, now's the time to go.
Was there a thing, sorry for being personal, okay, but, you know, I always hear about, oh, people are busy and you're busy with your career and he's busy with his career. But I always think, well, that's not really an excuse for not continuing a marriage. There's something.
Yeah, but
there's
if you some, grow
there's
apart.
Something that was going. Growing apart. It's kind of a cliche. I kind of understand it, but there's a part of me that doesn't understand it completely. Like, there's a part of me that says, "Look, I understand the part where you meet someone else and you fall in love, and I understand versions of that. But was this the kind of thing where you both just sort of agreed this is over, or did you realize he's not the one?"
Well, I mean, I was not happy. I mean, we really were growing apart and I could feel it. I could just feel it. You know, Dan, he really did have to work all the time. And I do think a relationship requires some care and feeding. It just does. And that's just the nature of what he was going through. You know, I mean, his particular specialty in medicine just required so much training and so many hours, and he'd come home spent. There was nothing left. And same for me. So I do think there's something to growing apart if you don't nurture things. And we were young, you know, we didn't have that many common interests. So time apart was probably more dangerous. Like, when we first got together, what did? We hung out with our friends. We drank a lot. We had a good time. So that was gone. And then I didn't want to watch the sports and I didn't want to do the gambling. And he didn't, I wanted to talk to him about the news or whatever book. And he didn't have time for any of that, you know. I remember on our honeymoon, he was reading the autobiography of Kurt Warner. And like, as a result, now I know a lot about Kurt Warner. And like, sure. He was on the Iowa Barnstormers and he was amazing. And like, but like, I wanted him to be more into the news and like biographies, and he wanted me to be more into Kurt Warner and that stuff. And it was just, you know, it wasn't friction. It just wasn't close.
Yeah.
So it was painful though, because when you leave a good for the possibility of a great, it's much harder than when you leave an awful for the possibility of a good. And I left a good.
Yeah.
And I knew in my soul, not Doug exactly, but that a Doug would be out there for me. And the thing about Doug is he is a very good looking guy, but he is smart and he's intellectual, but not in like an off-putting way where you're like, oh, shut up. He's like a gentleman, but he's also, in our relationship, he's the alpha and I'm the beta, which I know would surprise a lot of people. But like, he's in control. He makes a lot of the decisions, and I like that. Like, I don't want somebody who's subservient for me. I want someone who's going to take charge. And it's not like I don't have a say. I have a say, but like, he's a man, and I like that. And like, in every way, he's sort of a little bit more dominant, and for me, that works. So like, no, I don't want a feminine man at all. That would do nothing for me. Not that there's anything wrong with that. It's just, for me, that's not what does it for me.
Well, you know, so that's kind of interesting. So you have a first marriage and you don't have any kids, and you know, you're a few years in, but you're not 20 years in, and you kind of realize there's a little bit of there's an expiration date on life, marriage, women, more precisely. You know, you have a better shot at remarrying when you're 36 and you do it 57, or finding the Doug of your life.
I was 34 when I left Dan, so I was pretty young.
Right, but so there's a little bit of a calculation involved. I mean, there's an emotional part, but there's also sort of a pragmatic part, which is we don't have kids.
Yeah,
you know, I'm young-ish at 34 for sure, and I'm very desirable in this society that we have built. I'll just put it to you that way. I mean, you're beautiful, you're smart, you're vivacious, you're 34 years old, you're blonde. There's a good market share for you. So you think, I know it all sounds bad, but what I'm saying is there's a bit of a calculation there's a different thought of when you're 70 and you're with somebody and you need your social security checks and you're in for the long haul. And there's a sense of, you know, you got
to
know.
I know what you're trying to say, but I have to reframe it for you.
Please.
You're not exactly right.
Please.
You're not exactly right. So in my case, it was more, you know, going back to that thing I said about my dad, you know, like the clock is ticking. I know it's cliche, but it isn't a dress rehearsal. And if you've lost anybody at a young age, you know that in your gut. And I just looked around at my life the same way I looked around at my life when I left the law and thought, this isn't good enough. The way I feel, my level of happiness, the depth of my relationship and my connection, it's not good enough for me. And so at that point, Adam, I actually didn't think I wanted kids. I was just like, gunner of a lawyer, and I was working my tail off, and it was like, I don't have time for kids, and I don't know if I want kids, and I was like about my career, and I was doing really well, so it was like, I don't know. I don't know if I'm cut out for children. So I left Dan thinking that. Like, I knew I would, like, the point that we didn't have kids helped me leave, because I think it's harder to leave when you have kids.
Was Dan heartbroken, or was Dan understanding?
No, he was sad. You know, it was a very hard time. And I was sad too. You know, it was like, I will say this, we broke up in a good way. We were respectful of each other. We were kind to one another. We were both really hurt, but we handled it with enough tact that, you know, as I say, we're still friends.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm totally rooting for the guy, and he's a good guy. And I think I can say the same on his end, but we took care to handle it well. And to leave well. I do believe in general in leaving well,
mm-hmm.
in relationships, work, right. Whatever it is. But anyway, it wasn't until, so we lived in this little townhouse development in Arlington, Virginia. And I moved out and I got my own little townhouse in the same neighborhood. And it was my first night alone. And there I was lying in my bed. And it was actually at that moment in my own bed, in my little townhouse that I owned. I wasn't making a lot of money. I had just left the law for journalism, so I was making crap money, but it was mine. And that was the night I thought, oh my God, I actually might want children. Now that like anything is possible, I actually might want children. And when I met Doug and fell in love with Doug, like there was no doubt. I just had this like primal attraction to him. You could see yourself, you know, as the mother of his children. And I'll tell you something else. Shortly after we, you know, started getting to know each other better physically, he was in my townhouse one morning and he looked at me and he looked so good. And he goes, the women out there are going to appreciate this, but he looked at me and he goes, if you don't want children, you should tell me soon. I was like, oh my God, I will have that man's children as many as he wants. And so like from that point forward, it was a no-brainer. And now we've got three great kids and I'm totally happy as a mother. It's not my world. You know, I have a lot of other things that I need to have in my life, but it's awesome. I love it.
Well, God willing, I'll be your third husband one day down the road. With home improvement skills, Megyn Kelly, you should know.
Yeah, well, Doug does not have that. He's not handy. As his friend Addison says, when you look like Doug does, there are certain things you don't have to do.
Well, at a certain point when the eyesight starts to fade and the thoughts about home improvement really come to the fore, that's when yes. I'll slide in.
And you're handy with a car, and Doug is not handy with a car. So, you're making a real shot of this.
You married Ty Pennington, but I got to tell you, I have the real home improvement skills. So we'll talk off the air. Megyn Kelly, by the way, the Megyn Kelly Show, it's a great podcast. I was honored to be on it last week, and I'll be happy to come back anytime you like, Megyn Kelly.
Love to have you. You're our highest rated episode so far, our most downloaded episode. And if you look at the reviews, the comments, everyone's talking about you.
Well, you know, I love being interviewed, and I love being interviewed by someone who really, I was actually talking to Dr. Drew about you not too long after I did that. And I was like, you know, obviously you're a beautiful blonde and you come in this package, but really substantial and really a really strong interviewer. And I thought, I love being interviewed by people who really ask questions and really know how to conduct an interview, which if you're listening, young folks, takes a while. It just takes a while to get those chops. It's really about repetition. It's not,
well, thank I don't you. Know what you're going to learn. I think that you have an advantage and I have the same advantage, which is we're regular people. And like, honestly, like your background in construction and my background is just a middle-class girl from upstate New York. I think they're good. I think they're good for understanding what people want to know and like just having a natural instinct for what is interesting and what's not. And you also like have nothing to prove. It's like, I am who I am. Some people like us actually do have a chip on their shoulder, but you don't, I don't. I just want information. I don't care. I make no apologies for where I come from. I kind of love it. I love the background I have. So it's an advantage, I think, in interviewing because you're never trying to prove something about yourself and you have a natural instinct for what people are interested in.
I concur. Megyn Kelly, thank you so much for joining me today. And hopefully I'll see you soon on your show or I'll see you soon on my show.
Anytime. I'd love it. Thanks, Adam.
Thanks, Megyn. Take care of yourself. All right. Let me hit BetterHelp here. Overwhelmed and anxious, depressed. BetterHelp Online, licensed professional counselors who are trained to listen and trained to help as well. Look, there's a lot going on out there, people. I'm just talking to my dad today, who's a therapist. He's still got a couple of patients in New York City. 89 years young, talks to. It's important to talk to someone these days. There's a lot of people need it. And I would go ahead and include everyone when I say a lot. Connect with your counselor in a safe, private, online environment. Everything shared is confidential. Fill out a questionnaire that assesses your needs to get matched in under 48 hours. Easily schedule secure video or phone sessions, plus exchange unlimited messages as well. Take care of yourself with BetterHelp, right, Dawson?
BetterHelp is a truly affordable option, and our listeners get 10% off your first month with discount code Corolla. So why not get started today? Go to BetterHelp.com/Corolla. That's BetterHelp.com/Corolla. Talk to a therapist online and get help.
And last but not least, quick 15 seconds for Simply Safe. Simply Safe, you shouldn't feel unsafe at home, and you won't if you get Simply Safe. Two eyes, SimplySafe.com/Adam, and get free shipping today. All right. I want to tell you guys, I'm going to be in Stockton today at the Brookside Country Club. You can come out and say hi. And also Lafayette, Louisiana, Cajun Dome, Saturday, October 24th. We're doing a live podcast there with Dr. Drew, and we're also doing a stand-up show there as well. I'm your emotional support animal. Enjoy that. Leave a review on Amazon. Megyn Kelly, The Megyn Kelly Show. Enjoy that podcast as well. Until next time, Adam Carolla. For Bull Bryan, Gina Grad, Megyn Kelly, say it. Mahala.
Follow the Adam Carolla Show on Twitter at Adam Carolla Show. And follow us on Twitter at Adam Carolla. You can leave us a voicemail at 888-634-1744. Thanks to Bet Online. And pick up Adam's new book, I'm Your Emotional Support Animal. It's available everywhere. Get the links at adamcarolla.com.
Hey, movie lovers, who needs a theater when you have Pluto TV? Grab your popcorn and your streaming device because free movies are here. Pluto TV is your home for movies. Great movies are playing anytime in over 20 exclusive movie channels of action, horror, rom-coms, and more. Watch hits like Saving Private Ryan, Pretty in Pink, and Charlie's Angels all for free. No signups, no fees, no contracts. Ever. Download the free Pluto TV app on any device.